for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama used his strongest language yet to call for Colonel Muammar Gaddafi to immediately resign. New protests broke out in Tripoli as rebels held on to control of the oil port city of Brega. In Pakistan, the country's only Christian cabinet member was assassinated, and two U.S. airmen were killed in a shooting at the Frankfurt airport. Joining me in the studio to talk about the week's top international stories on the Friday News Roundup, James Kitfield of the National Journal, Courtney Cuby of NBC, Tom Jelton of NPR. And we will open the phone shortly and take your calls, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning and happy Friday.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
Tom Jelton, you're just back from Tunisia and the Libyan border. We learned this morning that a ship carrying about $160 million worth of Libyan currency has been impounded after turning back from a planned trip to Libya, and that's said by a British government official. The ship, whose nationality and ownership she refused to identify, returned to Britain after its captain decided not to dock at Tripoli Harbor because of the unrest there. What do you make of this?
That's a very interesting story. And you wonder whether someone in the, whether Gaddafi himself or someone in his government is looking to get a supply of currency? Does it mean that they are beginning to have trouble accessing their own cash in their own country? Libya is an extremely cash-rich country. This is a country that, of course, produces a lot of wealth. There's a from oil. There's a sovereign wealth fund there. And most of that wealth, most of the money in that sovereign wealth fund has been in cash in Libyan banks. So you have to wonder whether perhaps the sanctions regime is beginning to really bite and whether the government there is having trouble accessing that cash. But, you know, it's an intriguing story. We really don't know yet what it means, do we?
What do you make of it, James?
That would be my best guess, too. I mean, what's interesting is it was coming back into Libya. So maybe he has this money stashed someplace else and he needs it to spread around to buy friends right now because he doesn't have enough friends.
All right. Courtney Cuby, yesterday, President Obama made his first public statement on Libya since the outbreak of the armed conflict. What did you make of his statement?
Well, his comments were very strong, and he warned that Libya could ultimately turn into a bloody stalemate. He was echoing some strong language from Secretary Clinton in the most recent days, including saying that it could be a protracted civil war in Libya in the coming days. What you really have to look at, though, from President Obama's speech is he's moving along the bar of what the international community is going to be willing to tolerate here. Now, there's been a lot of debate this week about what's the next step. Obviously, the UN Security Council has imposed sanctions. The U.S. has frozen $30 billion in assets, which goes back to the money problems that Gaddafi is facing. But what's next? Will the international community impose a no-fly zone over Libya? Possibly. It doesn't look as likely right now, but it's possible still.
I thought it was interesting that Secretary of State Clinton earlier in the week talked about a no-fly zone. Then you had Defense Secretary Gates say any talk of a no-fly zone is premature.
Well, you know, Diane, I think that one of the things that military officers like to do is to emphasize to their civilian counterparts or superiors, that nothing is easy. And I think that they are often worried that civilians make statements and decisions and commitments without realizing the practical implications of what they're talking about. And Secretary Gates was so blunt. He said right off the bat, he said, let's call a spade, and a no-fly zone is not a passive operation. It begins with airstrikes. And he wanted people to be sure that they understood that what you're talking about is opening yet another military front, war front in the Middle East.
Let me reinforce that statement, and I'll go on the record and say, and I think a no-fly zone is extremely unlikely that we want to get in the middle of what's looking less like a genocide against people protests and more like a rebel movement and civil war. We don't typically like to get ourselves in the middle of foreign civil wars. NATO has said that basically it wants a UN Security Council resolution before it would contemplate this. That resolution is not going to come from the UN Security Council. Russia and China object to the idea of intervening in these kinds of situations. NATO itself seems to me very unlikely. It's stretched thin by Afghanistan. It's not likely, and that leaves the Obama administration, which would to sort of do it unilaterally. I don't see this administration at this time wanting to open another front in a Muslim country in the Middle East.
And you're looking at this point, there will not be a UN Security Council resolution that approves a no-fly zone. So that would mean it would have to be some sort of a coalition of the willing of the international community who would be willing to dedicate, 100 jets, that would be willing to go in offensively in the beginning and take out air defenses in Libya, and then potentially face the reality that the Libyan military could attack coalition air forces that are going over the country that are enforcing the no-fly zone, and then they would have to respond. It's just going to be continuing to escalate if the no-fly zone is actually implemented and Libyans respond.
And Diane, actually there's been some talk from the Arab League that maybe there could be an Arab enforcement of a no-fly zone with the African Union. But the truth is, because of the capabilities that are required for this, as Courtney just mentioned, there's no way that anybody other than the United States can do this.
Now, you've got forces loyal to Gaddafi standing up against the rebels. You've got these oil-rich areas trying to, the rebels are trying to hold them. Where is this going, James?
It's not going to a very good place, and that's why Obama's rhetoric was so strong yesterday, I think, because they can see this sort of getting into a stalemate, and a very bloody stalemate. I mean, it seems like that Gaddafi has support enough to hold Tripoli. The rebels in the east are saying they might move on Tripoli. That would be a bloody conflict if it happened. His forces have tried to retake, the oil port you mentioned. Were repelled. So this is looking very bad. We really would prefer to find a way for him to step aside. I would imagine right now there are people who are saying, we can probably put together some sort of an exile deal for you, but you have got to step aside. He's a total wild card, and we're not even sure of his mental grasp of the situation. He seems at times not to understand. He's always been a little bit delusional. He seems even more so under the pressure of the situation.
And when he made his statement on Monday, he said nothing's happening. Everything's fine.
No, and almost comical was the attempt to shepherd foreign journalists around Tripoli and even into Western Libya last weekend, promising to show them that Libyans support him. And then they take the journalists into these areas where they find the people up in arms against the Gaddafi regime. It makes you wonder about his grasp of reality.
And another thing that's still confusing and up in the air is these airstrikes that there is now evidence that the Gaddafi's military have done some airstrikes in the Benghazi area. The question is, what's the motivation behind this? Mm-hmm. Because they're not hitting, they're going after the strategic area with this oil port, but they're not hitting actual buildings. They're not going after civilians. So Gaddafi's son Saif said, oh, well, we're just trying to scare the opposition away. We're trying to get them away from this strategic area. But then there's also some speculation. It's possible that this is a sign of defections on the part of the Libyan Air Force, that they intentionally are not hitting those locations because they no longer support Gaddafi.
And what about the International Criminal Court's warnings to Gaddafi, James?
Well, you know, that's kind of why the International Criminal Court was established. We are not a sort of a cooperating member of the criminal court, but we have in issues like Rwanda and genocides like that have sort of cooperated with it, even though we're not a sort of member of it. I don't think it'll have a lot of impact. He's got bigger fish to fry right now than worrying about an eventual criminal court warrant for him. I think that he has to worry about his neck right now.
Tom, you were there. What did you see? What did you perceive?
That's right, Diane. I was just camped out on the border between Tunisia and Libya for about a week. My intention was to try to my expectation was that I think a lot of us were assuming that this government was going to fall, might have actually fallen by now. And a lot of us were there camped out on the border waiting for the government to fall so that we could go into Libya. And of course, nothing happened. That border never opened. But what we did find was a dramatic humanitarian situation on the border. When I first got there at the beginning of last week, there were a couple thousand people coming across the border each day, mostly Tunisians, and they came across and went home. By the end of by last weekend, that number was up to 5,000 to 10,000 a day, and they were largely non-Tunisian. They were largely Egyptian, and they had nowhere to go, and they were piling up at the border. And what had begun as a very orderly and impressive operation by the Tunisian military to handle this inflow of refugees, by last weekend and even more this week, had really degenerated into a chaotic situation. And now the UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, is calling it a humanitarian nightmare.
Well, don't you have Libyan police now at the border, Tunisian police stopping the flow?
There are a lot of refugees piling up at the Tunisian side of the border, but we also understand now there are refugees piling up on the Libyan side of the border that aren't able to get across. So we don't know about that side as much, but there's a humanitarian problem on both sides.
Tom Jelton of NPR, and short break. We'll be right back. And here's our first email from Jonathan. He says, Libya's violence commands most of the media's attention, but recently Egypt's leadership seems to be playing musical chairs in setting up a non-Mubarak government that repeals the state of emergency. That said, it's amazing to see oppressive governments across Africa, the Middle East, and Asia scrambling and running scared about the spark of democracy catching on in their own countries. James.
Yeah, I was writing on this about this week, talking to a lot of people, former national security advisors and others, who basically use words like this is an earthquake and probably the most fundamental change we've seen in the region since the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. So we're watching something develop here that is historic, unprecedented, and hugely important, but no one understands what's going to come out at the other end. And that, as I wrote and as many people think, what that means for us is that in the short term, all our core interests in the Middle East have gotten harder to protect and defend. The flow of oil, number one, we've seen oil spike dramatically at a time when we're trying to get out of this recession and the recovery is fragile. Containing Iran, we saw two Iranian warships pass through the Suez Canal, something Mubarak never allowed in 30 years, suggesting that maybe the containment of Iran is going to become more difficult. So basically, our counterterrorism operations, we're very worried that these Islamist groups, on one hand, whether al-Qaeda groups in Libya and in Yemen might take advantage of the chaos, and the other hand, whether some of these democratic transitions might get hijacked by Islamist groups that would make counterterrorism very hard. And finally, Israel's security. Israel is very, very disturbed by all this unrest around it. It's a status quo power, and there's no status quo to be maintained anymore in the Middle East. So in the short term, this is going to be very, very complicated and difficult for America to deal with. Again, when you can't look at what's happening and not be hopeful and proud of what these people are trying to do for themselves and to get
but
a voice in their own governments.
Don't know.
But hang on.
You know, there's one country that we have not mentioned and that is not getting mentioned, and that is Algeria. And Algeria, I think, represents kind of a cautionary note because there were elections planned in Algeria about 20 years ago, 1991, and Islamist parties won the first round of those elections, and they were poised to win the second round. And the government got so unnerved by the prospect of Islamist parties coming to power peacefully, politically through the election process, that they canceled that second round of elections, and we had 10 years of bloody insurgency in Algeria. And for that reason, the Algerian people know that these kind of movements, democratic movements, don't always end peacefully, and they've actually been much slower to take to the streets now than other countries, and I think that's an example that we do have to keep in mind.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with James that this is an earthquake, but it's an earthquake where the international community should have seen some of the tectonic plates moving ahead of time, because there was a foundation of change that was brewing in that region for years, and chief amongst that being this bulging youth population, which we've heard more and more about, the youth bulge. But there's also been an increase in a more politically conscious middle class in that region. And when you look at the two together, and then this new social media, and more traditional media, Al Jazeera and whatnot, there's a tremendous gap in those two communities, in the frustrated, unemployed youth and this politically conscious middle class. There's a gap between the expectations of what they should have, which is a government that represents them and some sort of a voice in politics, and this frustration. And then when you get the two of them together, it created a spark.
Talk about why Egypt's prime minister resigned, James.
Basically because he was a close ally of Mubarak, and Mubarak, just days before he left himself, named this gentleman to prime minister. The protesters never bought into that idea. They've kind of bought into the idea that this Supreme Military Council will lead the transition to elections and democratic transition, but they didn't like the old hangers-on of Mubarak hanging around. So they put a guy, the former transportation minister, in his place, who was pre-vetted by the protesters, if you will, and the activists, and said that this guy would be, he's seen as a technocrat, he's seen as non-corrupt, two things that they're very much the top of the demands of the activists.
But is there a danger that a reform movement could fall apart, Tom?
Well, of course, because, you know, what you need particularly a country with as complex a political environment as Egypt has, what you need are institutions. I mean, that's the key to democracy. It's not elections. It's not political party. It's institutions. It's a strong judiciary. It's rule of law. It's all these things. And those are, you know, the military may have, you know, the best of intentions, but the military has no expertise in that. And as long as that infrastructure for democracy is as undeveloped as it is in Egypt, this is going to be a very rocky road.
And in a sign of the times, one of my favorite parts about this entire story is that the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, which is essentially ruling Egypt right now until the elections are held in several months, made the announcement that they were accepting his resignation on Facebook, on their Facebook page.
And I would just add to that that, you know, to those four core interests that we have, key interests in the Middle East, we've just added a fifth, and that is to make sure that Egypt's transition is not hijacked by extremists, because if that happens, then the whole shakeup we're seeing in the Middle East could turn very, very anti-American and against our interests. So we now have a stake in how Egypt transforms. Egypt will be the bellwether for the Arab world again.
And think about Yemen and the president's comments. how he had to apologize to the White House.
Exactly. When he's basically said this is all a conspiracy from Israel and the United States, and we're causing all this problem, clearly playing to domestic audience, but it didn't play very well, as you can imagine, in Washington. And he was, you know, because we are supporting him dramatically in his fight against Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb, we basically said, hey, what's going on here? And he apologized, called our top counterterrorism official, John Brennan, and said, yeah, sorry, I overstepped.
But that shows what a knife's edge he's trying to stay on.
Exactly.
I mean, he is very concerned about his political position there. And you take those two sets of comments together, you can see that.
He actually tried to form a unity government this week, and the opposition said, no, we want you out of here. So, I mean, when you look at those comments, President Saleh was clearly trying to play to the fears of foreign involvement in the country to build up and garner domestic support, but it clearly didn't work.
All right, let's talk about Bahrain, because opposition groups did give their demands to the ruling family. What could happen there?
Well, I mean, that's another one that the U.S. has to watch carefully, largely because it's home to the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet, which is one of the most strategic and most critical Navy installations in the world. It maintains access to Persian Gulf oil, also leads in the counter-piracy operations in the region off the coast of Somalia. So the question remains: opposition group has submitted their demands. They want to create a constitutional monarchy, which is essentially the king rules or the king reigns, but the people are ruling. And so far, the protests in Bahrain, fortunately, have been largely peaceful. The Khalifa family has a little bit more credibility than some of the other monarchies that we've seen in the region. And the question remains, you know, is King Hamad going to continue along this track of reform that he has implemented in the past 11 or so years since he's been in power?
So how likely do you think the people are to realize their demands?
Well, there's another dimension to the troubles in Bahrain that we haven't seen in other countries, and that's the Sunni-Shia split. That is a Sunni monarchy, and as such, it's closely tied to other Sunni monarchies, particularly the Saudis. And the protesters, the majority population in Bahrain is Shiite. So there is another source of danger and tension. I mean, we do not want to see violence between Sunni and Shia. That's what has inflamed Iraq so much. That's kind of what the one thing you have to really be careful about in the Middle East.
That's exactly right, and it's the reason Admiral Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was quickly in Bahrain trying to basically calm the nerves of the ruling family. We will put a lot more effort in making sure that Bahrain does not slip into a full-out revolt, and the main reason is it's Saudi Arabia. It's right across a causeway from Saudi Arabia. The Saudi royal family is not going to let the fellow Sunni royal family in Bahrain, 15 miles away, fall to Shiites when their whole region around there, which is oil-rich and some of their biggest fields, are in areas where there's a Shia majority in Saudi Arabia. So Bahrain is closely tied to Saudi Arabia. I think that we can allow that to sort of crumble into, like Tom said, a potential civil war.
So the royal family is in effect doling out money to the population?
And reforms. I mean, and we've been pushing behind the scenes to reform quicker, reform more. We're trying to help them get ahead of the mob, if you will. But they were seen as sort of reformers, you know, as Tom said, benevolent monarchs compared to many in the region. So I think that you will see much more U.S. support to try to see the Bahrainian royal family through this crisis.
I want to ask you all about the reports on Raymond Davis and his connection to the CIA. Why did the Obama administration ask U.S. news organizations to withhold that information?
Well, it was for his safety, and it's one of those tough lines that you walk as a journalist when you find out the piece of information, but you know that it could potentially harm, put someone in danger. And there, by the time that it was evident that he was a contractor for the CIA, there was already tremendous outcry in Pakistan, calling for blood, calling for him to be killed for his alleged shooting of two Pakistani civilians. And then the ensuing, not even diplomatic headache, but diplomatic massive migraine of, you know, another civilian was mowed down by a U.S. embassy vehicle en route. One of the widows of one of the men who was killed took rat poison and killed herself. I mean, it just continues to snowball out of control. And it's become a tremendous domestic problem for the government in Pakistan. So right now, it's a diplomatic stalemate, basically.
And, you know, you have to have some appreciation for the position that the very weak government in Pakistan finds itself in right now. Because the truth is, if they just bow to U.S. demands and let this guy go, they're going to be faced with tremendous demonstrations, and they're also going to expose themselves to violent retribution on the part of Taliban and Al-Qaeda groups in Pakistan. So the Pakistani authorities are themselves in a very delicate situation.
But back to U.S. news organizations, do you agree with Courtney that it was for safety reasons, and it was a good thing to do, James?
I absolutely do agree with that. I mean, there is some history here, and it's not very pretty. We had a station chief from the CIA who was kidnapped in the 1980s by groups, and he was tortured to death in captivity because we couldn't get him out. And it was revealed that he was a CIA station chief. So if you got your CIA guy there, you know that he's in danger, and your first priority is to get them out of there. And I think the news organizations were just being correct in saying, let's see if that works. What happened was it didn't work. It did eventually leak. So now we've got a real problem on our hands because we can't afford to have this guy tried and certainly not hung. And at the same time, our cooperation with the Pakistani intelligence services is critical to the war in Afghanistan. So this needs to get resolved. I suspect this, you know, a lot of talk now about compensation we might be able to offer the families of the people who were killed. They call it blood money, but there's a tradition for it in that culture. I would imagine that we're trying very hard to accelerate those talks and get it done because the religious parties are trying to nix that deal.
James Kitfield of National Journal, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Are you suggesting, James, that paying that blood money could get Raymond Davis out?
I think that will have to be the deal that is cut because Tom's right. The government there is in a very precarious position. But if they can turn around and say, "Hey, we have this tradition. We keep it in operative because we want our own tribal society not to have all these revenge killings." So there is it is part of our culture, and the U.S. is stepping up, and I would imagine with significant money, and hopefully they'll find some sort of a deal.
And what about the assassination of the only Christian member of parliament?
That is an extremely alarming development because it's the second assassination, of course, in the last few weeks. Two major political figures in Pakistan, probably the two leading figures who opposed the so-called blasphemy law, one provision of which or aspect of which calls for the death penalty for people that blaspheme Islam. These two political figures opposed that law, and both have them now been assassinated. What I think one of the things that was particularly disturbing about this last case is that Mr. Bhatti knew that his life was in danger, appealed for security, and it appears that the Pakistani authorities, fearing to incur the wrath of the radical groups, basically refused to provide him the security that he was asking for and left him vulnerable, left him exposed to these groups.
And it was the Pakistani Taliban who claimed responsibility, Courtney.
It was, and officials at the scene found pamphlets that were talking about how the blasphemy law should not be repealed, and it had Pakistani Taliban came out and acknowledged that they had assassinated him. But I think this also begs one other bigger question, and that's that after the assassination of the governor of Punjab that Tom mentioned back in January, Prime Minister Gilani came out and told Parliament he was not going to change the blasphemy law. So despite despite the fact that Mr. Bhatia had come out against it, it didn't look like it was going to change. So it sort of begs this larger question: does that mean that there are that these insurgents, the Pakistani Taliban, are just going to continue to target with assassination campaigns these more liberal, forward, reform-leaning candidates in Pakistan until they're all gone?
And let's talk about the shooting of U.S. troops in Germany. What a tragedy. And how could that security have been so lax?
Well, you know, this reminds me of Fort Hood. It is a tragedy because we ask these people to put themselves in danger's way for us. And when they're in there, what you think is a safe area, suddenly there's no safety
somebody
for people in uniform.
Somebody gets on the bus and
right.
start shooting.
Right. And they're looking at whether there was a security lapse. But believe me, I've gone through Frankfurt. I lived in Germany for a long time. But I've gone through Frankfurt Airport with uniformed personnel many, many times. And nothing has ever happened. I mean, Germany was not a place you thought that there was any real danger. So this 21-year-old Albanian of Kosovar ethnicity obviously was radicalized recently. He was not on any counter terrorist watch list. Just walked up to a bus that was unloading people. It's one of those things. It's like a bolt of lightning. I'm not sure it's easy to protect against something like that.
What the big question that we have, Diane, is whether there was anyone else behind him in this shooting. And the reason for that is there have been a number of intelligence warnings in the last few weeks, specifically about Germany and specifically about Al-Qaeda members carrying out shooting attacks on individuals. I mean, so the incident itself conforms very closely to what was being warned. Now, on the other hand, he appears to be have acted, at least in that instance, by himself. And so we certainly do not know that there was anyone behind him. But it does. There is this unnerving connection to the intelligence warnings that preceded this.
Tom Gelton of NPR, when we come back, we'll open the phones, take your calls. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Nissan, with the 100% electric, no-gas Nissan Leaf. Innovation for the planet, innovation for all. Details at nissanusa.com. By the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And by Constant Contact, offering tools to manage, monitor, and measure social media. Learn more at constantcontact.com/social media. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, two performers who will be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame March 14th, Tom Waits and Alice Cooper, who's famous for his antics on stage.
I got a call the next day from Frank Zappa, and he goes, "Alice, did you kill a chicken on stage last night?" And I went, "No." He says, "Well, don't tell anybody. They love it."
Join us for the next Fresh Air.
For the international hour of our Friday News Roundup, it's time to open the phones. Let's go first to Jay in Madison, Connecticut. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Hi there.
Hi. I can imagine it being a rather slippery slope with unintended consequences. But what possibility, if any, is there for perhaps arming the rebellion in Libya with ground-to-air missiles, you know, the like of Stinger missiles, where they can essentially enforce their own no-fly zone?
James Kitfield.
They have armed themselves. They've raided some armories of the Libyan military. They have apparently, we've seen intelligence photos, apparently have seen, they have shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missiles. And this is a major concern because we don't know these guys. We don't know what they stand for. But when this has happened in Iraq, for instance, after the invasion there, where there was these depots that were unguarded and the weapons just sort of got stolen and went out, and a lot of them ended up in the black market, and a lot of them ended up killing Americans. Mm-hmm. Whenever you talk about shoulder-fired anti-air missiles, you're worried about civilian aircraft. And so not a good idea, I don't think.
All right. To Nashville, Tennessee, Ibrahim, you're on the air. Ibrahim, are you there? All right, let's go to Sarah in Vienna, Virginia. Good morning.
Good morning. My question is, why has Bahrain taken, why are they taking such a long time making these democratic reforms, and what type of government do you think will emerge there with their largely oppressed Shiite majority?
Courtney.
Well, King Hamad has in the past reached out in small ways to the Shiite minority population there. And so I think there's the more of a potential for Bahrain to move in a reform path than some of the other neighboring countries. You know, he's already in talks with the Shiite opposition. He's reshuffled his cabinet. So I think there's a better chance there. I don't think it's anything that you're going to see happen very quickly. But he also has the added motivation that we haven't spoken about, which is Iran backs some of the more extremist members of the Shiite opposition in Bahrain, and he wants to maintain a stable country. And so he has the added incentive of trying to keep the opposition happy and keep the flow of information and talks going.
I would just add to that that, you know, as we said, he has seen, especially his son, too, who's U.S. educated, as I recall, is seen as a reformer. I think they are trying to, I mean, why are they being so slow? Because when you have absolute power, it's kind of tough to give it up, basically. We've seen that in the Middle East for three decades. So it's tough for them to give up power. But I do think you'll see it sort of evolve more to like a Kuwait, where there is a parliament that does have some power, although the royal family retains sort of final say.
And slow is a relative term. I mean,
right.
Not that much time has actually passed, given how complicated these reforms will be.
All right. Here's an email from Larry, who says, I continue to hear about the war in the Middle East, but I hear very little about the war going on in Mexico. President Calderon met with President Barack Obama yesterday. What was accomplished? Tom.
Well, I think the most important thing was that the somewhat tense relations of recent weeks between the United States and Mexico were really smoothed over. There has been, a lot of harsh words directed against the Mexican government for what is perceived as its failure to kind of rein in the violence, to rein in the drug cartels that are responsible for so much of that violence. There were two customs agents who were killed in Mexico, and this really rubbed relations raw. And what President Obama did is he went out of his way to praise the Mexican government for the courage that it has shown, its perseverance that it has shown. And of course, thousands and thousands of Mexican law enforcement personnel have been killed in this fight. So President Obama really wanted to underscore the U.S. respect for that effort. Then there was another issue that was resolved, which was actually very important in U.S.-Mexican relations, and it's been simmering a long time. And that has to do with whether Mexican truck drivers are able to operate in the United States. Under the NAFTA accord, they should have been able to, as long as their trucks met safety requirements. But the Teamsters and other groups were very opposed to the Mexicans being able to drive their trucks in the United States. That issue was finally resolved, and that's something that was very important to the Mexicans.
I think that was the big deliverable from this meeting, and it sort of papered over the fact that there was two deliverables that were not met, one of which is, and both have to do with, the domestic position of these two leaders. President Calderon has been asked by the United States to let our agents in Mexico carry guns. That's a very unpopular move in Mexico, which has, for historic reasons, many sensitivities about U.S. involvement in Mexican affairs. And he wants from us that we, on our border states, have some sort of a law so when gun shops sell multiple rifles, big orders of that they are alerted and vetted and make sure they're not coming across the Mexican border, which they are. So neither one of the presidents got those deliverables. Basically, it's just too difficult to do domestically.
All right. To Jacksonville, Florida, and to David. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I'm just curious, how much did Obama's speech in Egypt, where the whole of the Middle East and the world was excited about the new president, and this was during his election phase, talking about change and vitalization, and then he sort of sat down and disappeared, not unlike he's done in the local politics of the United States. He's really lost us, it seems, all soft power and all rights to talk to others about change in the Middle East, because he talked about it so greatly and then disappeared.
Courtney.
Well, I think this goes back to what we spoke about earlier, which is President Obama was sort of at the, he gave that speech in Cairo sort of at the beginning of this moment of change. And there was as we said before, a large youth population listened to him in the Arab world. And they said, wow, you know, this man is bringing change to the United States. We can bring change to our countries. And so I think it's fair to say he inspired some of this change. Now, whether obviously there's the populations in each country that has to carry it out. But I think it's fair to say that President Obama did help drive.
So it's either inspiration or it's blame.
What? Well, I think the caller has a good point, which is that he clearly did inspire that movement, but then he kind of dropped the ball. I mean, and the truth is that none of that rhetoric meant that the United States was moderating its support for Mubarak, for the Mubarak regime. In fact, when this trouble started, you had Vice President Biden going way out on a limb saying that Mubarak was not a dictator, that he was a good guy. So I think that you can legitimately say, as the caller is, that, it's one thing to call for change, but the United States, President Obama did not back that up.
Well, we've been making devil's bargains with a lot of these dictators.
Yeah, I'm going to play a devil's advocate here a little bit, because I recently reread that speech, and it was very dramatic about the change that the autocrats and despots in that region needed to make to get in front of what we've seen here. They didn't do it. In many ways, it's up to them to do it. There was two deliverables that Iraq, that President Obama basically said that he would do to get back on the side of sort of the Islamic world. Pull out of Iraq, which we're in the process of doing, should have most, if not all, our troops out this year, and also re-energize the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, which they have tried very hard to do, albeit have failed miserably. And I think you could share the blame between the Netanyahu government in Israel as well as the Obama. But that was the two things he's trying to do to get back on the good side of the Islamic world, and I think he's had sort of moderate success.
All right, to Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Hi, Fernando.
Yes, hi to all. My point is, it's more a comment. And, it's generally the program, your program is a very even-keeled one. But I'm surprised how little regard in the case of this contractor for the CIA that killed two civilians, how little comment has been there about the killings of two civilians who actually did not even attack this gentleman. He was not defending himself. He thought they were going to attack him. And, and this brings the larger issue of the foreign policy of the United States that tries to protect individuals like this, or like Blackwater, for that matter, and supports dictator regimes like most in the Arab world, like Mubarak, and then in Pakistan also, and then claim in the public and larger world, claim to defend freedom and human rights.
Two points. every report that I've seen was that these gentlemen got off of a motorcycle while his car was stopped and approached him with guns. I have not seen any. There's no claims I've heard that they weren't trying to rob him. I tell you what his big concern probably was not getting robbed, but was being captured like Daniel Pearl was and have his head cut off. So if he's a CIA contractor, if we have people working in Pakistan, which we need to do, we have to have people to guard them. He's one of these people who guards them. And I, having spent some time with them, they will not be captured. And we've seen with these assassinations, there are extremists there who will kill you if you're not protected. So, I mean, unless you want to pull out of Pakistan altogether, I don't know what the alternative is but to have some security personnel protecting our intelligence people.
Tom.
Well, I think that this, you know, James made the point earlier that we have to protect our covert operatives, which is certainly legitimate. I think that there are some in the U.S. government that are a little uncomfortable with this case and with the behavior of Raymond Davis. There's some question of whether he was should have been carrying a weapon. I think there might be some. There are clearly some questions, legal questions, about the extent to which he actually has diplomatic immunity. Diplomatic immunity, which ordinarily should protect someone from prosecution in a foreign country, turns out not to be a black and white case. There are different types of diplomatic immunity, different levels, and it depends on what actually you did that you might be prosecuted for. It's not exactly a black and white case.
So his immunity hearing is actually what's coming up. Is that right?
And the United States is saying that he deserves diplomatic immunity. But, you know, from what I've read, there is some question about really whether he qualifies for full-fledged diplomatic immunity or not.
Courtney. This all started as a problem at the very beginning when the U.S. initially said that he was assigned to the consulate in Lahore, when in fact he's actually attached to the embassy in Islamabad. So the U.S. maintains that on January 20th, Raymond Davis entered the country. They informed the Pakistani government of his role as a, quote, technical and administrative advisor to the embassy, whatever that means, and that the Pakistanis accepted him in, accepted his diplomatic immunity, and issued him a diplomatic ID card. The Pakistanis are now saying, we never accepted him in the country and that he carries a non-diplomatic ID. The difference there being, diplomatic ID card gives you full diplomatic immunity, which is, under the Vienna Convention, an absolute right of no prosecution in the country's laws.
Courtney Kuby, she's national security producer for NBC News. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. To Amherst, Virginia. Good morning, Ken. You're on the air.
Good morning. I would like to ask the panel what their thoughts on about Gaddafi. Possibly the reason why he's acting the way he is because the international community is coming down so hard on him. I mean, you had the Tunisian president who left his country, had a safe place to go. Mubarak has got a safe place to go. But Gaddafi is being treated a little bit differently, and everybody's coming down on him and basically saying, look, if you continue doing this, we're going to prosecute you and we're going to throw you in jail. And that's the reason why he's fighting so hard to stay in power.
Well, Gaddafi sort of is responsible for his own predicament. I mean, Ben Ali, the president of Tunisia, was able to go to Saudi Arabia, but you got Gaddafi, who's been implicated in attempts to assassinate Saudi princes, a Saudi prince. So you can understand why maybe the Saudis aren't anxious to have him. He's created a lot of trouble in his part of the world, and he's made a lot of enemies, unlike Ben Ali or even Mubarak in that regard. So he does have a little bit of a different situation. It's a little more challenging. You know, he's not likely to end up in a very comfy place.
Do you think the U.S. will find a place for him, James?
I would think that that's part of the discussions right now, although he's reacted in such a heinous fashion that he might close all the doors of that kind of assistance. I mean, there are still African countries that he has been helpful to that I would imagine would give him exile. But if he keeps, mass slaughter, using his armed forces against people who are not armed, it's going to be very difficult for any country to sort of step up and offer him exile. So he's being his own worst enemy now.
And isn't Mubarak still a Sharm el-Sheikh?
That's another one of the million-dollar questions, along with some of the reports this week that he's very ill and suffering from cancer, which have been knocked down but are still sort of floating in the rumor mill in Egypt. And the question remains, where is he going to go next? Is he going to stay in Sharm el-Sheikh or is he going to leave the country? He says he's not.
Finally, to Chapel Hill, North Carolina, John Paul, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
The people that Raymond Davis killed were ISI intelligence service personnel. They were trailing him because they knew he was a spook. And these men were shot in the back. This is all over the press in the East. This is in the Pakistani mainstream news media, and you can find it on the internet news services like alternet.org, Information Clearinghouse, TV News Lies.
All right, sir. Courtney.
That report that they were ISI and that they were trailing him and he just got angry and it became a confrontation has been out there for several weeks. U.S. officials have denied that flat out, left and right. They're saying there's no indication they were ISI, that they were, in fact, trying to rob him. They had other cell phones. They had weapons of some sort on them. They were trying to this was not an intended hit, and they were not targeting him. So we have heard those reports, but there's no confirmation from here.
Anyone who's spent time in that part of the region knows that there's conspiracy theories abound. And there are details about this we don't know. I'm not sure they were shot in the back, but if they are, it certainly raises some questions. I will say that if they are unarmed, I mean, if they're not in uniform and they're trailing someone and they stop and get off their bikes and approach him with guns drawn, they're very stupid ISI agents.
James Kitfield of National Journal, Courtney Cubey of NBC News, Tom Gelton of NPR, and author of the book Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba. Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.